Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of James. Last time we finished chapter 2 with verses 24 to 26, which were, you see then how by works a man is justified and not by faith only. Verse 25, likewise also was not Rahab the harlot justified by works when she had received the messengers and had sent them out another way. And verse 26, for as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. And that brought us to the end of chapter 2. And Lord willing, we're going to start chapter 3 here. I'll go ahead and begin that. So verse 1, my brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. Here the apostle diverts to another matter, reinforcing what he had said in the first chapter of the evil of the tongue. However, this discourse is with good reason subjoined to the former. Those that vainly boast of their own faith are most apt to censure others, and they that pretend to religion are wont, or often, to take the greatest liberty in rigid and bitter reflections upon the errors of their brethren. Now he goes through the words of the verse. My brethren, the compilation, though familiar and usual to our apostle, has here a special emphasis. Number one, good men are many times surprised and usurp too great a liberty over the failings of others. Number two, he would not deal too rigidly himself, and therefore tempers his reproof with sweetness. Number three, the title carries the force of an argument. Brethren should not affect a mastership over each other. The next words, be not many masters. What is the meaning? The word master has diverse significations. Sometimes it is taken for an absoluteness of power and authority in the church. Thus, Christ alone is a master. Matthew 23, verse 10. His word is a law. His will is authentic. Sometimes it is taken for a subordinate teaching and opening the counsels of God, and those who do so by way of office are called masters in Israel, John 3, verse 10. And so some take it in this place and make the sense of the apostles dissuasive to be that everyone should not easily or unlawfully invade the office of public teaching. And the reason, knowing that we shall receive, etc., they open thus, because God requires more of them that are teachers than of others, and so by rash entering into the office, they run the hazard of the greater judgment. But the context will not bear this sense, the bent and drift of it being against the ill use of the tongue, and the reason annexed will not gratify it without much straining. And the scripture says that for not reproving and warning, we draw the greater judgment upon ourselves rather than by teaching or reproving. Ezekiel 33, verse 6. Therefore, this second sense is not proper, neither can the first be applied as masters to be taken for authenticness in the church, though Austin or Augustine and Beda seemed so to understand it, as if the apostle had dissuaded them from setting up themselves as masters and heads of factions and broaching novel doctrines, that they might appear in the head of a train, or in the scripture phrase, draw disciples after them. But this is wholly or fully alien and foreign to the apostles' scope. Master, then, is sometimes taken in the worst sense for a supercilious reprover, for one that has gotten into a chair of arrogance from whence he does magisterially enough inveigh against the practices of other men. And so it is taken here. The apostle makes choice of this expression, be not many masters, number one, to show he does not speak of public and authorized reproof. God has set some in the church that are to be masters of manners as the teacher and ecclesiastical magistrate. But because God has allowed a few, let not everyone be a master or turn censurer, be not many. We are all apt, but this itch must be killed. Number two, to show that he does not forbid private brotherly admonitions, such as proceed from Christian care and love, but such a reproving as was supercilious and masterly, managed with as much sharpness and rigor as a man would use to his slave, or a master to a scholar of the lowest class and standing. And so some understand that be not much masters, as if many for much. The next words, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. This is the first reason the apostle produces against the pride of censuring, which is grounded upon a consideration of the danger of the sin or the severity of judgment following it, a greater judgment, either from men. Censurers have their own measure, usually returned to their bosoms, and Matthew 7, 1 and 2, or from God, who can expect pardon for him that is severe to others, Matthew 18, 32 and 33. I chiefly understand judgment and condemnation from God, which is the more severe to censurers upon a threefold ground. Number one, the justice of retaliation. We condemn others, and God condemns us. We are severe to their failings, and how can we expect that God should be merciful to ours? Number two, because God is the avenger of injuries, Romans 12, 19, and among them, blasting the repute of others is the greatest. Number three, a censurer's sins are more aggravated because of that garb of indignation that he seems to put on against them. See Romans 2, verse 1. In censuring others, we do but pronounce our own doom and judgment, which the scripture manifestly represents to us in those known instances of David, 2 Samuel 12, and Ahab, 1 Kings 20, verse 39, etc. Observation number one, the best need dissuasives from proud censuring. The best people do. The apostle says, my brethren, be not many masters. And afterwards he puts himself in the number, if we, etc. It is the natural disease of wit, a pleasing evil. It suits with pride and self-love and feeds conceit. Proud nature thinks itself somebody when it can get into a chair of arrogance and cast out censures according to its own will and pleasure, as if God had advanced us into some higher rank and sphere and all the world had been made to be our scholars. It suits with self-love because it diverts the care of our souls. They that so narrowly look after the mote in someone else's eye forgets the beam in their own. And it strengthens self-conceit. So many evils in others make our own the less odious. It serves vain glory and provides for our esteem abroad. We demolish the esteem of others, that out of the ruins of it we may raise a structure of praise to ourselves. Now all these evils are in the best of God's children. Pride of life is last mentioned in 1 John 2:16 because it is last mortified. It grows with the decrease of other sins and thrives by their decay. Well then, suffer the words of exhortation, allow them, Hebrews 13:22. Some religious persons think such dissuasives as to them are either superfluous or injurious. This touchiness argues guilt. No evil is more natural. No evil desires less to be touched. Insensibly, it steals from our hearts into our tongues. We sin and do not think of censuring. Pride, being crossed, rages. Hear such matters patiently. James speaks to the brethren, be not many masters. Observation two, censuring, it is an arrogation of mastership over others. All teaching, especially reproof, is an act of power, and therefore the apostle forbids it to women, 1 Corinthians 14:34. Because they cannot have power over a man. Well then, when you are about to censure, check it with this thought. What power has God given me over my fallen brother? Why should I judge another man's servant? To his own master he standeth or falleth, Romans 14, 4. It is a wrong to God to put myself in his room. It is a wrong to my neighbor to arrogate a power over him which God never gave me. We all stand upon the same level. Needless and unprofitable censuring is but a bold usurpation, and besides the idleness of the words, IDLE, we shall give an account for the sauciness of them. Observation number three, Christians should not affect this mastership over their brethren. You may admonish, reprove, warn, but it should not be in a masterly way. How is that? Number one, when we do it out of pride and self-conceit, as conceiving yourselves more just, holy, wise, etc. Luke 18, I am not as other men, etc. He speaks indefinitely. With praise, a Christian may say he is not as some men. Some are as brute beasts made to be taken and destroyed. And with thankfulness, we may acknowledge that God has not suffered us to run into the excess of their riot. The Pharisee speaks as if he were above common weakness. Galatians 6, verse 1, restore with meekness, considering yourselves. We are all involved in the same state of frailty. Number two, when we do it as vaunting over their infirmities and frailties in a braving way, rather to shame than to restore them. As Ham laughed at Noah's drunkenness, this does not argue hatred of the sin, but envy, malice against the person. Paul's temper was truly Christian. Philippians 3:17, I have told you often and now tell you weeping, they are enemies of the cross of Christ. A good man takes no delight to rake in a dunghill. Others' failings cannot serve his mirth and triumph. My soul shall weep sore for your pride in secret places. Jeremiah 13:17. Censures are full of passion, but Christian reproofs of compassion. Such a difference there is between reproving out of pride and out of love and charity. Number three, when the censure is unmerciful, and we remit nothing of extreme rigor and severity, yea, divest the action of those extenuating circumstances of which the matter is capable. The censure should be extended no further than what may be necessarily inferred from the fact. Jealousy collected more than is offered, but charity thinketh no evil, 1 Corinthians 13:5. It reasons no evil, that is, does not seek to make sins, but cover them. As when an action is capable of two interpretations, it does not fasten upon that which is evil, or interpret doubtful things in the worst sense, or conclude a sin from an inevident sign, as Eli did from Hannah's fervency, concluded her drunkenness, 1 Samuel 1:14 and 15. Or if there be evil in it, it does not, by undue surmises, make it worse. As judge the heart by the fact, or by one or more single actions infer a habit or malignity in the offender. Or if that be visible, it does not prejudice their future condition. Though charity be not blind, it looks upon things as they are. Yet charity is not jealous to argue things into what they are not. It is against all law and right to be judge and accuser too, and to hunt out an offense and then censure it. Number four, when we infringe Christian liberty and condemn others for things merely indifferent, this is to master it indeed and lay snares upon the conscience, a wrong not so much to our brethren as to God's own law, which we judge as if it were an imperfect rule, James 4:11. In habits and meats there is a great latitude, and as long as rules of sobriety and modesty are not violated, we cannot censure, but must leave the heart to God. See Romans 14. Number five, when men do not consider what may stand with charity as well as what will agree with truth, there may be censure where there is no slander. Many religious persons think they are safe if they can speak only of others what is true. But this is not all. Every evil must not be divulged. Some must be covered with the cloak of love. There may be malice in reporting the truth. An eager desire to spread a fault wants or lacks not sin. Report, say they, and we will report it, Jeremiah 20, verse 10. Nay, if there be no ill intent, such prattle will come under the charge of idle words, I-D-L-E, for which we are responsible. The apostle forbids whispering and meddling in others' matters. At best, it is but a wanton vanity. All that we do herein should be to promote some aim of love and charity, that the offender may be seasonably reproved, or for some common good, that by the uncasing of a hypocrite, others be not deceived and ensnared. Number six, when we do it to set off ourselves and use them as a foil to give our worth the better luster, and by the report of their scandals to climb up and commence into a better esteem that we do. In the whole matter, we are to be acted by love and to aim at the Lord's glory. Well then, look to yourselves in your reproofs that they be not censures. They are so when they are supercilious and magisterial, the issues of pride rather than love. Envy often goes under the mask of zeal. We had need be careful, especially in times of public difference. For remedies, number one, cherish a humble sense of your own vileness and frailty. Others fall sadly and foully, but what are we? We are as bad, Titus 3, 2 and 3. We may be worse, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12. Bernard tells of a man that, hearing of a fallen brother, fell into a bitter weeping, crying out, "He is fallen today, and I may tomorrow." Number two, exchange a sin for a duty, 1 John 5:16. If any see his brother sin, let him pray. This will be a holy art and means to spend your zeal with least danger and most profit. Observation four, from that knowing that we, etc., a remedy against vain censures is to consider ourselves, Galatians 6, verse 1. How is it with us? Gracious hearts are always looking inward. They inquire most into themselves, are most severe against their own corruptions. Number one, most inquisitive after their own sins. The fool's eyes are to the ends of the earth, always abroad, like the windows of the temple, broad outward, narrow inward, curious to sift the lives of others, careless to reform his own. But when good men, it is otherwise, they find deceit enough in their own hearts to take up their care and thoughts. Number two, most severe against themselves, a good heart is ready to throw the first stone against himself, John 8, 4 and 5. Others can, with much heat, inveigh against other men's sins, and with a fond indulgence, cherish their own. Hatred against the person does but take advantage of the miscarriage to shroud itself from notice and censure, and though they hate the traitor, yet they love the treason. And observation five, rash and undue judging of others, when we are guilty ourselves, makes us liable to the greater judgment. The apostle proceeds upon that supposition. Sharp reprovers had need be exact, otherwise they draw a hard law upon themselves and in judging others pronounce their own doom. Their sins are sins of knowledge, and the more knowledge, the more stripes. Ignorant people have this advantage, they have a cooler hell. Well then, rest not in talking and prescribing burdens to others. It is a cheap zeal. But thinkest thou that thou shalt escape? Romans 2, verse 3 and verse 21. Thou which teachest another, teachest thou not thyself? Etc. There is little sincerity in that, as well as little self-denial. And hypocrisy will render us liable to condemnation. Hell is the hypocrite's fee simple. Matthew 24, verse 51. The phrase of receiving the greater judgment is also applied to the Pharisees, Matthew 23, 14, because of their hypocrisy. So that those that reprove, whether out of office or charity, had need look to themselves. Their sins are sins against knowledge, and so have more of malice and hypocrisy in them, and therefore draw on the greater judgment. Lewd ministers could not but tremble in their hearts if they were sensible of their work. God purified Isaiah before he sent him to reprove Israel, Isaiah 6, verse 7. Your first work should begin at your own hearts and then you will carry on the duty with more comfort and boldness. All right, and that is the end of verse 1. And Lord willing, we will continue on next time. But until then, go and always remembering to check your own heart. May we always do that and be careful about when we condemn others, and that we are full of charity. And may we ask God for that filling of charity in our hearts at all times. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.